This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening today. I'm joined by Emma Ashford, a senior fellow at the Stimson Center, and one of my favorite foreign policy analysts, who is a clear-eyed critic of U.S. foreign policy in general. She's written a lot about grand strategy, and we're going to get to that, the Middle East and the limits of American power. We're going to start off by talking about Iran, and then we're going to talk about the major themes of her recent book, First Among Equals, U.S. Foreign Policy in a Multipolar War, as well. Emma, thanks for talking to Reason.
No, great to be back.
Let's get right to it. You know, at this point, we're over a month into the war with Iran or in Iran. What is your sense of what the actual U.S. objective is for us in Iran, and does it make sense?
You know, if we go all the way back to like day two or three of this war, there was this big debate about what the US objectives were. And I think even at the time, it was pretty obvious that we didn't have clear objectives. And instead, what we had was this sort of big basket of things the US could be trying to achieve, everything from regime change to controlling the nuclear program, and sort of how we did in the war would depend how many of those we might get. I think what has now become apparent is obviously we're not getting the most extreme version of it. We're not getting regime change. But the administration has still only dialed back what they want from the Iranians a little bit. Lots of talk about nuclear questions, lots of talk about regional activity, and then, of course, reopening the Strait of Hormuz, which only became an issue after the war started.
Yeah. And I mean, there basically has never been a moment where the Strait was, you know, was closed off by Iran, right? I mean, I think there were like brief moments in the Iran-Iraq war, but somehow the major calamity or the major talking point now is to reopen a Strait of Hormuz, which was open before we attacked Iran. That doesn't speak towards any kind of strategy, does it?
One of the more interesting things about this war, honestly, is that the White House has managed to make explicit something that was always implicit, right? Everybody knew, if you talk to energy specialists, Middle East specialists, they'd tell you that if there was a major war that imperiled the regime in Tehran, they would probably close the strait through some combination of missiles and mines and drones and everything. What we have done here is make that a fact, right? Iran has now proven that they can, if not close the strait physically, then at least make it so that it's so risky that most ships and most intruders are not willing to let them sail through. And so now Iran has actually shown that it can do this. They're in many ways more powerful, more leverage. That's not exactly a good outcome.
What is there anything to think about? Like, why did the war start when it did? You know, you hear in, you know, particularly from people who are either hawks or supporters of the war in Iran, and there's some Democrats as well as Republicans or MAGA type people in Congress and the press and whatnot. But why did it start when it did? Or, you know, is there any reason to say, OK, that this is why it had to start this time at this day?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a good question because most people were not expecting this war. They were expecting some kind of maximum pressure campaign that would go for a long time. Everything that we've seen, and there's actually a lot of reporting on this at this point, suggests that this was pressure from the Israeli government, from Benjamin Netanyahu in particular, and that he started pushing back in, I think it was October, November of last year, and sort of put a timer on this, that Israel would act without the U.S. if we did not act. And this seems to have pressured the Trump administration to take steps in January, perhaps, again, not because they were necessary, but because the Israelis would move without us if so.
And there was that kind of, you know, very widely covered and pretty incendiary New York Times article a week or two ago that was essentially arguing that, you know, it was Netanyahu came to the White House and kind of told the same story that he's told, you know, the last several presidents about what Iran was up to and like, you got to move fast. But I mean, is it convincing that we, you know, were bombing Iran because of Israel? Or is this also something, you know, people talk about how Donald Trump, you know, going back to like, you know, before the Shah was deposed, was talking about how we got to get Iran and things like that. So, I mean, is this actually something, you know, that's coming out of Israel, or is it something that we can say, no, this was Donald Trump's decision?
So international relations scholars have this concept called entrapment or entanglement. And it's about where you have an alliance with another state and it sort of pulls you into war. And that sounds very much like it's all the other state's fault. But in practice, what this looks like in almost every case is policymakers in the US or in other states kind of feel like they have to go along with this. They see their interests intertwined with the other state. If you look at Vietnam, it looks kind of like this, right? The US policymakers feeling more and more like they had to act. In this case, I mean, again, I think much of the impetus for the timing and the real push came from the Israelis. But at the end of the day, Donald Trump chose to go through with this. He chose to start this war against the advice of even, I think, some of his closest cabinet members.
Right. And I mean, that New York Times story, not to get, kind of into media criticism, but it also seemed to be heavily sourced from people who were close to J.D. Vance or were ventriloquizing for him, because he has emerged he has been a critic of U.S. interventionism. And I mean, do you think that's true? Or, it's hard to, where does Vance land in all of this? Because he also, went to Pakistan and oversaw the, complete disruption in peace talks there. Is he actually a, an anti-interventionist? Or, what do you think's playing on within the Trump administration right now?
Yeah, I mean, Vance is an interesting guy, and in part because he actually built his political persona back when he ran for Senate and everything around opposition to the war on terror wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He served in, I believe it was the Marines, in one of those conflicts. And so he built his political persona around this. Now, I don't think he's a dove. I don't think he's a non-interventionist. I think he's perfectly fine using the military. But the pattern that we have seen over the last year and a bit of this administration is, whether it's those signal chats about the Houthi war, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's this war in Iran, Vance seems to be the voice that's saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't do this, maybe we shouldn't do this. And then he goes along with it once the decision is made. And that as vice president, that actually in some ways is about what he can do. He's not really able to resign in the same way as a cabinet official. So I think, he's in a very difficult position, but, I think he sort of should have known perhaps that Donald Trump was somewhat mercurial.
Yeah, because Trump also, like Vance, I mean, particularly in 2016, one of his best moments, kind of, at least from a relatively libertarian anti-interventionist perspective or non-interventionist perspective, was when he kind of put Jeb Bush in his place and talked about how, George W. Bush and even H.W. Bush had started a lot of wars that were stupid or dumb or whatever. Does Trump have a foreign policy strategy that is consistent, or are we, just seeing kind of blood sugar spikes, take over his decision making?
Yeah, it's really funny you mentioned that debate from 2015. Mm-hmm. I actually went back and looked at it a while back, and I had not remembered that right after that, you have a clip of Marco Rubio defending Jeb Bush and talking about how wonderful the Bush family are.
From Florida, right? Yeah, so.
It's been kind of memory hold with everything that's happened since. But I think, I mean, what's the concern here really is, right, Donald Trump told the American people that there would be no more stupid wars. And I think many of us, myself included, believed that he was opposed to those wars, when in fact, what it actually seems more like is he thought that the politicians that started those wars were stupid and they conducted them in a bad way. And if you listen to the way he's talking, even these days, he says, I wouldn't get us into another quagmire because I wouldn't do it like that. You look at what he did in Venezuela, quick in, quick out. He thinks that he can use military force without getting bogged down. And what we see in Iran, I think, is the limits of that theory, right? He doesn't want a ground war. That's very obvious. He doesn't want a lengthy war against Iran. What he wanted was a quick military strike that achieved everything he wanted. And he's run up against the fact that that's not going to happen in this case.
Even though he did that almost a year ago, back in June, right, when he dropped a bunch of bombs, big, beautiful bombs on Iran, and supposedly destroyed their nuclear program, which, of course, according to U.S. intelligence at the time, was not near prime time. But, he definitively said we destroyed it. And it looked like between that and something like Venezuela, there was and a couple of his other actions, he seemed to be providing an alternative model of intervention, right? Of military intervention instead of non-interventionism on the one hand, or, you know, occupying and staying for, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years in a place. He was like, no, we're just going to drop a lot of bombs. Why was that never a good kind of philosophy? Like, what are the limits of, you know, maintaining, you know, achieving foreign policy goals by dropping lots of bombs from very far away?
I mean, I'm not sure it's necessarily always a bad policy. There are times where it definitely works. But the risk is that there are times when it doesn't work. And so then you end up sucked in, you end up having to do more than you thought, or you learn, as the old phrase goes, right, that the enemy gets a vote. And so what we've seen in this conflict is, yes, we can inflict a lot of pain on Iran, but it turns out they can inflict pain on us too. And now we are stuck with that because we made that choice to use force in the first place. And so I think Trump's own instincts are very much in line with the sort of Jacksonian tradition in American foreign policy, you know, perfectly happy to use military force, but not wanting to sort of do all the work for other countries, not wanting to be overseas for years and years. But the risk, as I say, is that you don't get to necessarily choose. And so you can end up having to do more than you thought.
Very quick question. You know, he put a portrait of Andrew Jackson in the White House. Andrew Jackson was in many ways the first like fully formed imperial president who acted like a king. Contemporaneous critics of him called him King Andrew and things like that. Did Jackson actually have a foreign policy?
Jackson's actually best known mostly for the Indian Wars. But again, there's kind of this debate in American foreign policy historiography about are those foreign policy or domestic policy? I tend to think if you consider those as foreign policy, then yes, Jackson had an expansive foreign policy. But his name has mostly become associated with what some people would call the punitive expedition, which a lot of American presidents have done in history. But again, it's this idea of sort of in and out. You're not trying to build a liberal world order or League of Nations or nation build or any of those things. You're just trying to use the military to coerce other states.
Hey, Reason Interview listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago, from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme, Reason and Love, explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Alexis de Tocqueville in small dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't sit through lectures, they practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students explore Chicago's cultural landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, and that includes room for the full week with scholarships available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. Let me ask this. Trump said, I'm not going to get into stupid wars or the wars that we were in were done stupidly. I'm better than that. That also kind of calls to mind Barack Obama's characterization of dumb wars. Like, I'm not going to get into dumb wars. And by that, when, you know, somehow... And it's fascinating when, you know, you were talking about when you went back and looked at, you know, Marco Rubio's statements, which people forget. Obama was somehow elected as the peace candidate, mostly because he was not John McCain and he was not a Republican, you know, coming, running for office after George W. Bush. But, you know, he talked about dumb wars, but then he kept us in Afghanistan and intensified things. And he also fought tooth and nail for the Americans to stay in Iraq, even though we had been kind of voted out of the country by the government that we had helped create. My question here is there a continuity? And this goes to your work in your book, First Among Equals, U.S. Foreign Policy in a Multipolar War. Is there an actual continuity in post-Cold War American foreign policy across H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Trump, Biden, Trump again? you know, or how do you characterize American foreign policy in the post Cold War era?
Yeah. So, I mean, first, let me just say it's a multipolar world. I genuinely hope we're not in a multipolar war, at least not yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yes. No worries.
but no, I mean, one thing that you often hear folks say is that U.S. foreign policy has been consistent since the end of World War II, that we have, since we created these institutions in the 1940s and 50s, we have upheld a liberal world order. And one of the things that I argue in the book is that's not really true. In 1991, a lot changes about U.S. foreign policy. And it goes from being a relatively, and I'm going to say conservative strategy, small c, right? It goes from being a strategy of mostly defense or containment of the Soviet Union to this much more transformative, forward-leaning, we're going to change the world approach. And there's all kinds of different theories out there about how we are going to change the world. And if you look at some of these debates from the 1990s, they're really interesting, right? We're going to improve human rights. We're going to expand NATO. We're going to, in the 2000s, it becomes the freedom agenda under Bush. We're going to do all these things. But all of those are very transformative. And for me, that's what characterizes the post-Cold War period. And I think, this has been pretty bad. It's been mostly a failure. It's been very unpopular. And what we see starting with, so you asked about Obama and sort of onwards, what we see starting in about 2014 or so is politicians trying to respond to the fact that the American public really doesn't like this foreign policy. But most presidents have still continued with significant elements of it, even to this current president.
Is part of what was hemming in, before the end of the Cold War, and when we say, okay, well, it was hemming in, but we had major combat operations in Korea, as well as Vietnam in particular. But it is fascinating when you look at, the record of somebody like Eisenhower, who knew better than anybody how to run a war, how to win a war, how to, do a lot of stuff, really restrained. Also, Ronald Reagan, pretty restrained ultimately in terms of actual military engagements. But was that simply because the Soviet Union and kind of, global communism or international communism was so strong that it didn't make sense? Like if you started a war, you didn't know where it was going to end. And then once the Soviet Union is gone, suddenly we can flex because who really is going to stop us? Or, what explains the more expansive approach to foreign policy post-Cold War?
Yeah, I genuinely think it is the lack of constraints. I mean, during the Cold War, there's this ongoing debate about, should we do containment or rollback, right? Do we push the communists back out of where they are? And there were periods like Vietnam, where we definitely engaged in that approach. Mostly, I think we stayed in the containment mode. But that
because even in Vietnam and Korea, they were not necessarily fighting to take back all of Korea or all of Vietnam. They were just trying to maintain a boundary that had been set basically after World War II.
Yeah, exactly. And what we see is, even in each of those cases, right, the debates about what we should do were tinged with this knowledge that we did not want to get into that great power war and especially into a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. When we get into the post-Cold War period, that constraint largely goes away, right? The Russians are really weak. The Chinese are not yet that strong. There's really no other power that can actually constrain the U.S. So, for example, when we see debates about what to do in the context of, Bosnia, right, or the conflicts in the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s, the Russians are protesting like crazy, but the U.S. can basically do whatever it wants. And there's even this fascinating episode where the Russians try and send paratroopers in to stop the U.S. At Pristina, and they're unable to do so, and the Russians end up having to beg the U.S. troops for food.
Do you consider the U.S. actions in the former Yugoslavia, were they successful in accomplishing their goals, and, or are they part of the legacy of failure?
You know, Again, this is a difficult question because I think we can look at a lot of these post-Cold War adventures and we can see that some good came out of them, right? There is definitely a case to be made that the US helped to stop the slaughter in parts of the former Yugoslavia. Or if I was to pick another example, NATO expansion almost certainly helped to stabilize Eastern Europe and put it on this path towards sort of Western capitalist economics, right? And so that benefited lots of people, but both of them also had downsides, right? And costs for US foreign policy later, like NATO expansion, helped to worsen relations with Russia. So I don't think we can say all good or all bad, but we do have to acknowledge that this had costs.
Is Biden, you know, who has already, you know, forgotten, you know, in most ways, you know, certainly he's not being discussed for a variety of reasons, but was his foreign policy qualitatively different than any of the presidents, you know, in the post-Cold War era? Because he seemed, you know, he got us out of Afghanistan, even though everybody knew that should have happened literally decades before. He supported Ukraine, but was pretty steadfast about, okay, we're not putting boots on the grounds and things like that. Was he a breed apart from, you know, the typical post-Cold War American president?
So I think Biden, a little bit like Obama and Trump to a certain extent, is responding to the notion that Americans are quite unhappy with US foreign policy. And I think, you know, ending the war in Afghanistan was one obvious way that he could do that. Now, then we also see how difficult this can be politically because he ended up paying some political price for the way that withdrawal went. Could he have
done that better? Or is that kind of like when you lose a war, the bug out is always going to be pretty ugly?
I think it ended up being extremely ugly. There probably would have been scenarios where it didn't look quite as bad. But I mean, yeah, I think it was always going to end up roughly where it did with the Taliban in control of the country. It was really just a question of whether it happened as we left or after, right? What Henry Kissinger called the reasonable interval in Vietnam.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But with Biden, I just want to say, I mean, I think, you know, Afghanistan is one case, but then on Ukraine, you're right. He was somewhat restrained and he didn't want to get in a direct conflict with Russia. But at the same time, he allowed the US to be pulled into escalating both the weapons and assistance given to Ukraine and also the demands that were being sought in order to end the conflict. And his administration eventually basically refused to even try and negotiate an end to the conflict. They took a lot of other steps, including sort of trying to build up US alliances, things that are probably going to entangle the US overseas for much longer. But because it's less showy, it's less flashy, it's not things exploding, I don't think we think it's quite as bad as some of these other actors.
How do you grade U.S. involvement in Ukraine? Is it, you know, because this, it, you know, one of the arguments is that you have to stop Russia, you know, from taking Ukraine, because if they take Ukraine, then they're going to take Poland and, you know, they're going to reconstitute the Warsaw Pact. That seems far-fetched to me, but it also seems in many ways almost an absolute good that, you know, Ukraine still exists as a free republic, both for the people in Ukraine, whatever, you know, horrors that they're facing and death and destruction, but also as a way of saying to superpowers, like, no, you can have one of the very biggest armies in the world and you still can't win. That seems to be a good lesson. But how do you think about Ukraine and the U.S. involvement in it?
This is where, again, I think Biden actually deserves a lot of credit, because I think his early policy on Ukraine was actually pretty much right. It was, this is not in the US interest to fight directly, but we can help the Ukrainians, right, in different ways. We can help them to defend themselves. And in doing so, you know, maybe we can't protect the entire country, but maybe we can help them give the Russians enough of a black eye. They can negotiate a good peace. Where I think the Biden administration, though, went wrong was that the early victories in that conflict, I think, really bred a sense of sort of, you know, absolute victory. And when it came time to start talking about those negotiations, when Ukraine was in a good position, there were several periods in the war, about 3 months in, about a year and a half in, when we could have negotiated, there was a lot of pressure on the Ukrainians themselves not to do it from the US, because maybe if we just work at it longer, then you can get more. And in that, I see some of the thinking that really pushed us in Iraq and Afghanistan to stay for 20 years, because we're just saying, well, as long as it takes, we're not really sure how, but we'll get there eventually. And so that's, I think, for me, where the Ukraine policy really fell off the wagon.
Do you think, to switch back to Iran, is the U.S. main target Iran, or are we sending a message to China or to Russia or to whatever global powers we want? Like, you talk a lot about how we're in a multipolar world, and I keep about to say multipolar war because I'm worried that that's where this all ends. But in a multipolar world, let me rephrase this slightly differently. Does Iran represent a serious threat to American interests that we should be neutralizing them, in and of itself? Or is the primary function or a large function of our attacking Iran is to send a message to other bigger powers?
Yeah, I mean, look, Iran poses a limited threat to the United States. If it gets a nuclear weapon and missiles that can range the United States, then yes, they could inflict harm on us. The other major way they can hurt us is by closing the Strait of Hormuz and damaging our economy. Mm-hmm. So, in some ways, again, the self-fulfilling prophecy. I do not put a lot of credence in the arguments that this is all some three-dimensional chess to get to China. If anything, the US has dramatically weakened its position vis-a-vis China. We have sent a ton of equipment, ammunition, radars, everything to the Middle East. We've stripped them out of places like South Korea that want them to defend against China. And then we're saying, well, our defense industrial base can't even backfill these things for many, many years. Now, again, I am somewhat skeptical that the Chinese actually do want to invade Taiwan, especially in the near future. But I can say without a shadow of a doubt that this war has made that easier just in practical terms, because the US weapons that would be needed to defend against it, they're gone.
Why do you, can you explain a little bit why you're not that worried about China as a martially or a militarily expansionist power?
Yeah, I mean, look, I have no doubt that China is very serious about Taiwanese reunification, that they will do it through, not just peaceful means, maybe coercive means. But I think, like a lot of folks, I do not believe that this is going to be some full frontal assault across the Taiwan Strait, simply because it's going to be an incredibly heavy lift for the Chinese military. Taiwan is, just in terms of geography, pretty easy to defend, very difficult to attack. The Taiwanese have a lot of sort of advanced weapons, and there are easier ways for the Chinese to do this. So my primary concerns—
What are those ways?
How the Taiwanese can defend?
How the Chinese can kind of reunite with Taiwan.
Okay, yeah. So I think the one that's most commonly talked about is some sort of blockade strategy. Mm-hmm. So that the Chinese might blockade traffic in the strait, make it hard for Taiwan to import, food and goods and all kinds of things, but the most important thing is probably oil. They only have about 10 days of reserves on the island. So you do that and you try and force the Taiwanese government to come to terms. Very similar, in fact, to what the White House says we're doing on Iran right now, right, with this blockade.
If China does something like that, should the U.S., pursues a policy of strategic ambiguity over our exact kind of defense responsibilities towards Taiwan, would that be, something that the U.S. government should get involved in if China says, okay, we're going to absorb Taiwan?
I mean, I don't think that the U.S. should be fighting a direct war over Taiwan. I feel about Taiwan much the same way I feel about Ukraine, which is that we do not have a formal treaty, the interests are not there. And to be frank, China's interests in Taiwan are always going to massively outweigh ours, and they are probably going to win that conflict as a result. But that, again, that doesn't mean that we can't help the Taiwanese to defend themselves. And that's, again, where I think stripping some of these assets from the region is such short-sighted thinking.
Two final questions. The first is, could you explain, what is the basic, your preferred basic principle for American foreign policy? Because people used to talk, I remember this was, I guess, even before the end of the Cold War, but people would say, that American foreign policy should be about protecting American interests, not saving the world. And, when Jimmy Carter started talking about human rights, things got bad, et cetera. But, what's the basic ethos that you think is, what American foreign policy should be, should be built around?
I adhere to a pretty basic realist understanding, which is that US policymakers and foreign policy should be focused on the prosperity and well-being of the American people. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't need to be engaged in the world in a lot of different ways, but I do not believe that being everywhere all around the world fighting all the time is in the interest of the American people. I don't believe that a $1.5 trillion defense budget is going to be good for us economically. And again, I think this war in Iran really shows the ways in which our military adventurism can actually hurt our prosperity at home. So I would like to see a U.S. foreign policy that is much more focused on things like ensuring free trade, ensuring defense of the sea lanes, defending core American interests, and a lot less of this sort of either the more democratic liberal values part of it, or the Republican sort of we should go out and coerce everybody version that we've seen in the last year.
Final question. Is there a way to pull back from the kind of maximalist rhetoric that Trump is now using with Iran? And J.D. Vance said, too, like Vance, when he left Pakistan, said, we gave them our best offer and they said no. So screw them. Or we're not budging. Obviously, we're in a negotiation. But is there a way to kind of unwind some of the rhetoric around Iran without, in a way that Trump will save face so that he can do it?
I mean, I think if anyone can, Trump can. He's actually shown himself to be quite capable of climbing down in crises. And in some ways, I think the question is why in this war in Iran, has he not tried to find a way out at this point when it's become so costly? I do think that it seems that negotiations are set to continue, maybe as early as Thursday. It seems that the two sides were a ways apart, but not necessarily completely opposed on certain issues. There's rumors in particular about a moratorium on enrichment rather than sort of zero enrichment as a US red line. Maybe it would be a time frame where they're not allowed to do that. And that actually is something you can negotiate. So I do think that it is possible still that we get out of this through diplomacy. I also think it's equally possible that if we don't, that Trump just calls it quits and comes home after a while. Because again, keeping this going, it's not at all clear whether there's any good options and what pursuing them would actually do. So I hope that we can pull back from this. It's not going to look good for him when he does.
Is there any way to help the Iranian people who suffered? The Shah's regime was a brutal authoritarian regime. And then it's even worse under the Islamic Republic. But is there any way that America and American people can help people who are in that kind of situation short of, some type of military action?
I mean, I actually think that one of the better things that could potentially come out of this war might be the lifting of some of the sanctions on Iran, if there is a potential deal. Because the regime is absolutely brutal, no one should be in any doubt about that. They killed maybe more than 10,000 people as recently as the end of last year. But at the same time, what mostly hurts the Iranian people on a day-to-day basis is the economic pain. Part of it created by US sanctions and the inability to export oil, and part of it by the fact that the IRGC, as a result, controls a huge amount of the economy. If the sanctions were to go away, a lot of those distortions would go away, and the Iranian people would be at least a little more prosperous. And I feel like over time, that would be far more helpful to them than sort of what we've been doing, which is really cracking down, saying it's on the government, but in practice, mostly hurting the people.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Emma Ashford, a senior fellow at the Stimson Center, and the author most recently of First Among Equals, U.S. Foreign Policy in a Multipolar World. Thank you, Emma.
Thanks so much for having me.